This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I'd now like to introduce our second speaker, David Hallam, who's a senior conservator with the museum. David was the driving force behind that 12-month scientific analysis of the nameplate and the marriage of the scientific analysis and the historical record that resulted from the last 12 months of activity on this was really quite fantastic. And David, I'm looking forward to hearing about your revelations from what science can tell us about the nameplate.
I think one of the most fascinating things is that eventually Leichhardt got to Perth. But it wasn't quite in the way that he expected to. He was flown to Perth in an aircraft and stuck into a vacuum chamber attached to a scanning electron microscope. So that's basically what I'm going to talk about. The question I was asked was, is it real? You know, it's a seemingly simple question. In most cases, it's impossible to prove an object's authenticity. But the process we undertake at the National Museum allows us to make a balance of probability assessment. Looking deeper, the question we had to answer was the plate made before 1848, or was it a later fabrication? Again, it sounds real simple. But you can't date metal. You can't just carbon date it or put it into a machine that goes ping, that tells you, yes, this was made in 1835. What you can do, though, is you can look at the technology of production, the methods of fabrication, the evidence of the environment it's been in, and the evidence of the stress it's been under. Together, these will prove verifiable causal links to the object's provenance. In other words, links to the story that we get from Bristow Smith. They will show these links are non-existent, or they will show that these links are real. If they exist, the story is real and we can tell it truthfully. One of the things we need to think of is objects in a museum. Most modern museums have made a shift away from the way we look at object authenticity. We have moved away from representing objects as having defined identities, towards saying, this is the object, this is what we think we know about it, please use this information and make your own assessment of what you think about it. One of the best ways of getting information out of objects is to look at them, and to look at them really closely. We can look at the surface. We can look at them stylistically, we can look at things like patina and corrosion products, and we can look at usage. The techniques that I used were my eyes, then an optical microscope, and then to look at them, we also looked at them under a scanning electron microscope. I'll point to these areas of interest once I can get the cursor. Here we are, yes. The plate is made of brass and it has letters stamped into the front of it. Using what I'll describe that later, and then at this end it has some numbers that are made up of stamped and engraved numbers. On the back it has some cuts It has strike through, where someone's hit the stamps very hard, hard enough to bend the metal and distort it. It's got black corrosion product. It's got a copper overlay on the surface. Strange one. It's got a bit missing of the copper overlay round this pinhole. It's got file marks on the surface. As you can see here. You can see there the style of the lettering. Now, the style is consistent with early 1800s. You can see here the 8. And see how the 4 is made up of a composite. You've used eyes and little bits of other letters. You can see, again, the file marks going across the surface. The file marks have actually happened after the stamping was done. Because when you stamp a piece of metal, you distort the edge around the stamp mark. And you can see all the file marks have happened after that. There's a close-up of some cuts on the back. These cuts are very similar to the kinds of cuts we sometimes find on Aboriginal breastplates. I've got no explanation for that one. This is how the letters would have been made. Basically on an anvil, engineers' letter punches. Now here you can also see the copper overlay on the surface as well. These are the engraving tools that would have been used to make the 8s. The person who did the engraving was definitely not as skilled as this engraver here, because they had several goes at doing the 8s and got them wrong several times. If we have a look at the letters, we'll find that they have a filling in the letter, and I'll get on to discussing that a little later. If we carry on looking, we can start to look at things like the corrosion products that we find in the various areas of the plate. We've got zinc-rich areas, we've got sulfide corrosion. If we then actually start to look at some of the chemical analysis, we have several methods we can use for chemical analysis of something like the plate. Obviously, you could grind it up and do a macro analysis on it and end up with no plate. You could do an analysis that used a very small amount of the object. You can do analysis that is destructive. You can do analysis that is non-destructive. For this kind of operation, we always aim to do things that are totally non-destructive to the object. So in this case, we had to use what's called an environmental scanning electron microscope, which exists at CSIRO in Perth. Here's some pictures of the plate going into that microscope. We have also used X-ray fluorescence and Raman microscopy for analysis, and I'll talk about that a little later. We are considering doing some laser ablative mass spectrometry, some neutron activation, and some metallurgical replication analysis on the plate, but that has not yet happened. This is the X-ray fluorescence analysis machine that we used on the plate, and here are some pictures of, if I can get the cursor up, the plate in front of our X-ray fluorescence machine. Now, if we look at the X-ray fluorescence data first, you'll see that we come through with copper percentages about 60, zinc about 35, and lead about 0.4. In other areas, you'll have copper percentages about 76, zinc about 18, copper about 65, zinc about 31, copper 75, you'll see that the surface of the plate is actually very variable. Our X-ray fluorescence data complemented the data we got under the scanning electron microscope. This is the data we got under the scanning electron microscope. This is far more accurate than our X-ray fluorescence data. And you'll see that we come through with an average zinc composition of about 36% and an average lead composition of about 1.5 with no tin. And as a comparison, we have metals from dated sources as a comparison. One of the things we're currently doing is going through looking at the brass breastplates in the National Museum's collection and looking at those that are dated and then comparing them with this data. And we're finding a very good correlation. Okay, what do we know about copper and zinc and brass production in the 19th century? We know that early on, in order to make brass, what you got was you got some copper and you heated it up with zinc oxide. And that produced a brass that had a maximum percentage of zinc of about 32%. Normally it was around 20. It wasn't until 1832 that Muntz patented a method of mixing together copper and zinc metal to get a brass with a much higher zinc concentration. This was mainly used for things like ships' hull cladding. So this is something that would have been quite available in Australia. From looking at the metal composition, we can say that the Leichhardt plate was made from the combination of copper and zinc metal. We also believe, but I have yet to prove this, that it is a British zinc was used. From about 1880 onwards, copper was electrolytically refined, so we would actually end up with a lot lower levels of impurities than we have in the Leichhardt plate. This is for those the area of the composition of the Leichhardt plate, where it fits into a phase diagram of zinc. And if we have a close look at the surface, we can see here a really close up of some of the scratching file marks on the surface. And when you look at it really close up, we're going up to 400 times here, so it's not that great, you can actually start to see the lead crystals. And there, there, and there. You can also see that the zinc, the surface of the metal, has dissolved. You can actually see little marks in the surface, and you can see detritus in the scratch marks. You can actually see there's an amazing amount of detritus in there which could be analysed and looked at. But the dissolution pores, these little things here, you can see all over the surface. That shows that it's been in a very corrosive environment. Which moves on to the corrosion profile. Things that we look at here are the dezincification. If you have brass and you put it in a corrosive environment, the zinc goes into solution. That is called dezincification. When the zinc goes into solution, the copper goes in to solution with it and then is redeposited onto the surface and plates out. That's why the Leichhardt plate has a coating of copper on the surface. It's fairly even. It's not very well adhered, but it's there. We also found the presence of sulfur and chloride in the corrosion products, and I'll go through these in the next few slides. This is a close-up of an area, and here you can see one of the letters. You can see there the copper overplating, and you can see the base brass metal. If we look at the brass, you can see copper, zinc, and chlorine. If we look at the copper, you can see copper, you can see all whole mess of corrosion products here. Little bits of aluminium, magnesium, carbon, oxygen, and on it goes. It's a real potpourri. If we take another look, here we see our sulfur coming through in our corrosion product. And again, you'll see aluminium, silicon, magnesium. Take another look. Copper, zinc, chloride, sulfur. And if you look at the copper overlayer, you'll see just copper coming through, which shows redeposited copper. When we look in the letters, one of the things which really threw us was we found titanium. Now, that's one of the things that when you're looking at doing an authentication study on a work of art, as soon as you see titanium, you go, oh, post-1930s. We found titanium and we thought, well, what form's it in? We did Raman microscopy and we found it was a titanium dioxide, a pigment. Oh dear. And then we found a photograph of the plate on display in the South Australian Museum with white pigment in the lettering, which is what we can see. And that was actually taken in 1935, when titanium would have been quite available. We also found amorphous carbon in the lettering. This leads us to believe that there was a resin in the lettering and that it was exposed to a low temperature fire in a reducing environment. And basically what was produced in the lettering was the equivalent of carbon black. Here's a Raman of the spectra we found and the spectra of carbon black. These were the conclusions of our analysis. A lot of the data you get visually and under a scanning electron microscope is very hard to quantify. And one of the things that Dr. Ian McLeod, when he first saw this thing, he said, it looks real. It looks like this. The finding of the lead under the scanning electron microscope was the clinching piece. Modern brasses from about 1850 onward don't have that composition of lead in them. The sulfur. Where would you get sulfur from? You know, if it was Rotorua, fine. But where in the natural environment would you get sulfur from? If it had been in an anaerobic environment, buried in a peat bog, then you'd get sulfur. But where else? There's only one source, and that's black powder. Chloride. Where would you get that from? Well, it was on a horse. It was with a sweaty person. But also, the nitrates in black powder from that period had very high chloride concentrations. Black powder was incredibly corrosive. The zinc hydroxychlorides were the clinching thing for the arid environment. They only exist and only are produced in an arid environment. The presence of the other elements, the potassium, the aluminium and the silicon are just the kind of thing you'd expect from someone rubbing an object with ash from a fire. The Raman testing found colloidal carbon, and this is highly likely that this indicates a low temperature fire. Now, the colloidal carbon and those things we can analyse by laser ablative analysis, but that's semi-destructive, so that's going to be an interesting one. The physical evidence by looking at the thing that it's been bent to me also was very telling. How, if something is held onto a stock with a pin and you're just trying to remove it, how are you going to do it without bending it? It's also this evidence on the plate that it has been then been straightened out again. You can see hammer marks on the back. And you can see that these hammer marks are post-corrosion. We speculate that the brass was reformed from another object. And that's because we can see on the back an O and the cuts in it. And when you look at the structure of it, it's not a very nice piece of metal. You know, it's a beaten old piece of metal. It's not terribly consistent. And that leads us to wonder, this is only speculation, whether it was made in a blacksmith's shop on the Darling Downs. You know, in a hurry, just before he was about to go. It's quite possible. I think one of the important things to remember is that an object's story does not cease after it enters a museum collection. Acquisition gives museums access to the primary source material, and this object is definitely primary source material. Enables the museum to undertake research that few individuals have the resources to undertake. I'd like to acknowledge these people for their assistance with the investigations. And thank you.
Thank you.
Those are my references.
Thank you very much, David, and thank you for keeping to time, and to Daryl too. Much appreciated. I must tell you that when David took the plate to Perth, and Leichhardt finally got to Perth, as David was saying metaphorically at the beginning, sadly without the man himself, but when David took the plate over there for these studies at the CSIRO with Dr. Ian McLeod, you know, we all waited with bated breath. What would it show? You know, would we get the smoking gun, no pun intended? You know, would we get that piece of evidence which would show that it was an early 19th century piece of brass? And I'll never forget the rather animated and excited phone call that I received one afternoon at my desk from David in Perth saying, there's lead in it, there's lead in it. And that proved that the brass was from the right period for our sakes, that it wasn't a later piece of brass that had been fabricated. But then on top of all of that, of course, you had all that wonderful evidence that came out of this tiny piece of brass and what it could tell us scientifically. So, some questions, and there is the mic to speak into. Peter.
Peter Stanley, National Museum. I'm not an expert in anything that's being discussed this morning, so I'm thinking, what is my role? And my role, I suppose, is as a devil's advocate to ask questions that might help to illuminate the truth. And I see you taking a pugnacious stance, David. It's what you said is very interesting. But the plate is reported to have been attached to the stock of a weapon, a musket,
yes.
I suppose.
Yes.
Do we know of any other muskets that have brass plates like this with names attached? Was this a common thing? Is there physical evidence that would support the attribution of its origin?
Yeah. In the War Memorials collection, there certainly are plates on rifles, from the late 1890s, 1880s. Some of the Boer War stuff, people, you know, wrote their names and beautifully engraved things. So yes, there are. It was a habit of people to name and put their names on weapons.
Right, and whereabouts? On the base of the stock or on the side? What's the?
I don't think that this could be on the base of the stock. This would have to be on the side of the stock, and it would also have to be inlaid into the surface of the wood. And you can see that there's been an attempt to do that. You can see that the final filing of the plate was done when it was in something. And to have it only held by one pin, you know, it would have to be inlaid. Inlaid and glued, maybe, with an animal glue. There is a precedence for that. And I think there's a precedence for Leichhardt naming his stuff too.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, if I could just add at that point that there is evidence that Leichhardt was very methodical with his gear and quite possibly had a numbering lettering system for the equipment that he took with him. And we also know through Darrell's research that there was a chap in Victoria called Bennett whose descendant lives here in Canberra, actually. We actually met recently. Bennett provided a pair of pistols to Leichhardt, which were engraved with, from RB to LL. Now, they've never been found, but Bennett wrote about this in the Victorian press in the 1880s. So there's another precedent for someone having given firearms, in this case with an engraving. Now, that's engraved into the metal, presumably, not a separate plate.
Yeah.
But that is further supporting evidence for the fact that someone either gave him this firearm or at least the plate to mark his passage through that part of the country. Darrell.
Yes, Darrell Lewis from the ANU. Just on where the plate was on the gun, almost every gun I've seen, my father was an antique gun collector and I've seen hundreds and hundreds of guns of all vintages and so forth. Just about every gun I've ever seen has had a specially made and shaped plate to go on the end of the stock to prevent the wood from splitting if you bang on the ground and it was curved to fit your shoulder and so forth. There's no way that plate was on the end of the butt. It was on the side somewhere.
Yeah.
That's all.
Thanks. Another question? Fighting metallurgists in the audience? Dick?
Sorry, I have no particular expertise in any of this, but I found the presentation fascinating for the detail. But one of the things, I think I'm right in saying that Charles Harding, who owned it originally, used to often have it wrapped up in a bit of cloth. And I wondered with the, you're a bushman, you're going to have grease of various kinds, and if you're going to show that to someone, almost certainly, I think you intimated it, you're going to lick your finger and rub it a bit, or you mentioned about ash from the fire or something, you're going to have people rubbing the butt with different things, and I wondered if there might also be some oil on the rag or something you'd use as a preservative sort of a thing. It's only a speculative possibility.
There's a lot of rubbish in the letters, and that's the best way I can describe it. Those letters are almost a micro-archaeological excavation waiting to happen. Now, there's an immense amount of information, I think, still hidden in the object. And, there could be pollen in there. There could be remnants of people's sweat. Could be all kinds of things. Because it's a many layered. You've got the carbon layer, but then you've got the titanium whites. And under that, I'm sure there's another layer of calcium oxides and things like that. So there's in those letters themselves, there'd be quite an amount of investigation we can do to find gosh knows what.
Any further questions? Yes, thanks.
My name's Dave Underwood. I was rather surprised at the size of it. It's rather large, I thought. You were talking about these ones over at the War Memorial. What size are they? Are they this sort, is that culturally the size for that era? You've answered. I was going to ask you about one hole rather than two.
Yeah. That would quite easily fit onto the butt of a rifle.
But I'm saying at that time, for that time.
About that size. Sometimes.
It's pretty big. Yeah. This day and age, they're much smaller, aren't they? We're all used to all these trophies kids get.
Yeah,
they're much smaller. So
I mean, I think the size of it was governed by the size of the lettering they had. Yeah. I mean, you can only just fit on. And my impression is that they only had one set of lettering, whoever did this. And that was the size it had to be to fit on.
I have another question, if I may. Any speculation as to why it was hanging up in a branch, or was it inside the baobab tree, or do we have any ideas about that?
We don't. We can only speculate upon that. Whether it was left as a deliberate marker in the landscape, you know, this is where we were, we are dying, this is our memorial, it'll be found above the ground, more easily seen. They're the sort of logical things that spring to mind, but we can only speculate until we find further evidence. Thanks. We might make this the last question, if you don't mind.
Philip Jones, there's been only a fleeting reference to the gun, and I wondered whether people were aware of the attribution by J.B. Cleland in 1938 to the possibility of it being Gilbert's gun. In a letter to Dr. George Bennett of Sydney in 1847, September, Leichhardt mentioned the possibility of using Gilbert's gun, which had been come into his possession. And I just wondered whether you knew any more about this and what sort of a gun it was.
Well, could I? I'm assuming, Philip, you mean Gilbert, as in the first expedition who died on the western side of Cape York.
And he had apparently received this gun from Gilbert's widow.
We don't have any information on that. Darryl, do you have a comment to make on that?
Look, there's absolutely no information about what kind of gun it was. It was just a partly burnt and rusted gun. We don't even know if it was in a bottle tree or leaning against it or stuck into it by force. We have that little bit of information that it was found in a bottle tree. And undoubtedly, the expedition had more than one gun anyway. Each man would have had a gun of some sort, you'd think. One account has it that Leichhardt was allowed to pick police carbines for all his members. Now, I'm not sure now if that was for the first expedition or the second, but the chances are, if it was the first, he would still have them for the second anyway. So until someone finds the remains of a gun near a baobab tree marked with an L, we won't know what it is.
But thank you, Philip, for raising that suggestion. Just wait for them. We have another minute, so if you just wait for the mic. If you just wait for the mic, please.
Just to follow up on that, it doesn't it seem extraordinary? I mean, we know it is Leichhardt's gun that this is from. And we know that the gun was actually collected and was in the possession of Charles Harding and was subsequently thrown away, which seems to be rather odd. I mean, that you would... surely you would even keep the metal parts of the gun as a relic, as sacred as the plate itself. It strikes me as odd.
I don't think if you were on the edge of the desert, you would bother to carry a dead, out-of-date, rusted gun. You'd just leave it there. You wouldn't carry any more weight than you had to. And I think one of the things you must remember is that this gun would by then have been definitely old technology. And it would have been about as useful as a Hewlett-Packard calculator is nowadays. What do you do with a Hewlett-Packard? You pick it up and you throw it in the bin. Well, you sell it on eBay. But you certainly wouldn't cart it halfway across the world.
If it has Ludwig Leichhardt's name on it, I think you would. Mm.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question, Philip. And we have wondered about that too. You know, there's lots of things that... there's a lot of questions that this story raises. We've been able to get answers to a large number of them, a pleasing number of them. But things like that, you know, Daryl and I have talked about where might the firearm be. But we know that it was not only rusted but burned. So, you know, what condition was it in? Obviously a very deteriorated condition. And we presume that he discarded it for that reason but kept the plate because he recognised that as the greatest thing of value. We might call it quits there. David, thank you very much for a great presentation.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.